understand not only their genius as musicians, but also, and perhaps more importantly, the place that they had in American culture, in the American landscape, and the ways in which they made a tremendous difference in terms of white America, a certain segment of white America coming to a new appreciation for what black musicians had to say. It's a beautifully written book published by Mariner, again called The Jazzmen. And Larry Tye, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Great to be back with you, Greg.
My understanding is that what prompted you to write this book, basically the first book you've ever written about music or musicians, was prompted by another book that you wrote quite a few years ago that I hope someday I can write, I can read, a book called Rising from the Rails. First of all, briefly explain to our listeners what that book was about and what that has to do with the creation of this book.
Sure. So the earlier book was about the Pullman porters, who were the black men who worked on the railroad from the end of the Civil War until the 1960s. And that was, during that era, the best job a black man could have. And these guys went on to spawn the leading doctors and political figures and scientists and everybody in the black community that made a difference, seemed to have a relative somewhere who was a Pullman porter who inspired them. And the Pullman porters made me promise when I wrote about them that someday I would write a book on their three favorite passengers, who were Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. And the reason they were their favorite passengers says a lot about those musicians, about the porters, and most importantly, about what America was like in the Jim Crow era of segregation. When these incredible musicians, who were at the top of their field, would travel below the Mason-Dixon line, if they chose the wrong restaurant to try to eat in or the wrong hotel to try to book a room, it could be the last choice they ever made. They could be berated, they could be beaten, or they could end up at the end of a lynching noose. And so what they did when they had the money, and they had the money starting in the 1940s going into the 1960s, they would rent a private Pullman sleeping car to go south with them. And if they were playing a concert, let's say in Atlanta, that car would be off on a sidetrack. And at the end of their concert, they would know they had a great meal waiting for them, prepared by the dining car guys. They had a plush bed waiting for them, made up by the Pullman porters. And most importantly, they had a safe haven. And in return for that haven, they would, in the middle of the night, put on a private jam session just for the Pullman porters. And Greg, I don't know about you, but if I could go back to any moment in American history, I wouldn't mind being in the closed capsule of a railroad car and the Duke Ellington Orchestra play just for me.
Very good. Yeah, I share the sentiment very much. And I find this absolutely fascinating that it would be these Pullman porters would play such an important role in you writing what is one of your most fascinating and impressive books. As we've already, as I've already mentioned, you've never written about music before. As far as I know, you have no significant musical background from which to draw. But you say in the preface, "I've tried to make a strength out of being a newcomer to music history." Explain how you went about doing that, or how in your lack of experience could be, in a sense, turned to your advantage in writing The Jazzmen.
Sure. So to rephrase your question in a less diplomatic way, the question might be, what is a tone-deaf, middle-aged white guy doing writing about three black musicians like this? And the truth is that I was tone-deaf, and I would have to ask my wife the difference between harmony and melody and all kinds of basic concepts. But like a journalist that I was for the first 20 years of my career, you would start the day knowing nothing about the topic that you had to explain to readers by the end of the day. And so what you did in between the know-nothing and the know-enough-to-write-about phase was you talked to a lot of people. And in writing this book, I talked to 250 people. They range from great jazzmen like Wynton Marsalis and John Batiste and Sonny Rollins to political figures like Bill Clinton. And had I called those people up and said, geez, I'm a writer who knows everything about my topic and all I want is a couple quotes from you, they would have hung up on me. But instead, calling Wynton Marsalis and saying, look, I know nothing about these three jazz greats, but I'm trying to explain them to people. And if you care about them as deeply as I think you do, you'll help me understand them. And a guy like that, who was incredibly busy, ended up after a couple hours of talking on the phone saying, here's my cell phone, and if you need me for anything else, just call me. And it was a blast going in, knowing nothing, but coming out feeling like I understood their music better. And more importantly, as you've pointed out, my book was not the 101st book on the music of these three guys. It was the first book on their lives off the bandstand and how they made an equally important contribution to America by what they did when they weren't performing.
Mm. You mentioned that all three of these gentlemen wrote memoirs, but particularly two of them, those written by Count Basie and Duke Ellington, are, in your words, deliberately opaque about their private lives and feelings. And Louis Armstrong, in terms of all that he wrote and shared with the world, also did not reveal a whole lot about this aspect of his life. How difficult a challenge was it to be able to explore this part of their lives, their three lives, without having, in a sense, their own voices leading the way?
So on the one hand, it was imposing. They were, Count Basie's memoir was like a poorly written travelogue, and I'm convinced there are only three people in the world who have ever read that book. Count Basie, his collaborator writer, who must have been the most frustrated guy on earth, a guy named Al Murray, who's a great jazz writer, who had to have been frustrated because he tried like heck to pull good stories from Count Basie, and the Count wasn't obliging. And the third person who read it was me. And I think that if these guys had told story about their lives generally and their lives especially when they weren't performing, then I wouldn't have had a book to write because the story would have been out there. The fact that they didn't do it was, on the one hand, a challenge, and on the other hand, an opportunity. And it was great fun because I wanted to show myself and show my readers that I could come up with things about them that they had been reluctant to talk about themselves. And they were reluctant partly because all three of them said, we speak through our music, and that's all we really want to say on issues of controversy. And I thought that wasn't enough. And I thought that they spoke so loudly through their actions off the bandstand that somebody ought to talk about that.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Larry Tye and talking about his most recent book, which is called The Jazzmen. And the subtitle really says it well, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. It is a remarkably thorough examination of the lives and careers of these three great jazz musicians, and in particular trying to examine the way in which they made such a difference in the American landscape. I think you do a great job, especially of talking about Louis Armstrong and explaining the dramatic transformation, in a sense, that occurs as he as he reaches later into his life and career. And that smile is almost always there. But you help us understand that what was behind that smile sometimes was different, and that, in fact, it wasn't just one smile that the world was being shown, even if the world sometimes failed to understand the distinction. You write, his mask was his smile. Sometimes it was conveying straightforward joy. In other situations, it shielded heart-wrenching sadness. Tell us more about this aspect of Armstrong's persona.
Sure. So if we could take a minute and just go back to Armstrong's roots, which helped explain what his life was like after that. He grew up in a part of Louisiana in New Orleans during the heart of the Jim Crow defeated Reconstruction era in American history. He grew up in a setting where blacks were segregated and given unequal access to everything from water fountains to parks to libraries and schools. And he grew up in a part of New Orleans that was so rough and tumble that it was known as the battlefield. I think his life was saved as well as transformed when at age 13 he was plucked off those tough streets by a police detective and sent for 18 months to a reform school. And in that reform school, he learned how to play first the bugle, then the cornet, and then how to play a trumpet, hitting notes that nobody had ever hit before and would ever hit again. And I think it was in that process of learning that he had a skill that could never be taken away from him that he was able to confront the world. And his, as you point out, later in life, he was accused of being an Uncle Tom and an Aunt Jemima, that he was accused of pandering to white audiences and giving up the essence of his blackness. And the idea that this kid, who had grown up facing these kinds of Jim Crow barriers, the idea that he would try to appeal to a white as well as black audience, and that that would somehow be held against him, is a tragedy. It's a tragedy that I was as much a victim of as anybody else in terms of underestimating just who he was and just the kind of suffering that his smile was disguising. And every day, just about, of his adult life, he began life spending 30 minutes in the bathroom rolling a big fat joint and getting high. At the end of every day, in his dressing room, he would sit alone and roll another joint and get high. And I think he was doing that not just because of the rigors of the road of being out there for 365 days a year, but it was because of the tension, the idea that people couldn't understand that you could be an entertainer and an artist at the same time. And the only way he had of relieving that kind of pressure was by smoking a joint.
You tell us in the chapter called Breakthrough Battles, and again, this is taking the story into the 1950s. You tell us Louis Armstrong's activism was the most counterintuitive, and that is because it was, you know, when he engaged in activism, it was in such stark contrast to his outward persona. And you tell us that he actually, in a sense, erupted in anger in the wake of what was seen in Little Rock, Arkansas, with the so-called Little Rock Nine, as integration became a reality in that otherwise all-white high school. I had never heard about what Louis Armstrong had said on this particular occasion, and it is fascinating to think about somebody being moved to speak out in a way that was so contrary to the way America saw him at that point in time. Tell us what was going on at this point in Louis Armstrong's life and career, and what a difference this made.
So I want to take your listeners back to 1957, and this is when the Little Rock schools were ordered by a federal judge to be integrated, the all-white high school called Central High. And there was a racist governor named Orville Faubus in office, and he said, essentially, over my dead body, will you integrate the school? Our war hero, President Dwight Eisenhower, said, I'm not going to send in federal troops to protect those nine black kids who are trying to integrate that school. And this is an era where Wisconsinites will know better than anybody that it was the heart of McCarthyism, the heart of a right-wing tenor to the country, that it was difficult for white and black leaders to summon the courage to speak out against what was going on in Little Rock. And a young newspaper reporter showed up in Louis Armstrong's hotel room and asked him the innocent question, what do you think about what's going on in Little Rock? And as you say, Louis erupted. He called the governor a word that begins with M and ends with R, and that I won't say on the air on your public radio station, but it got translated into family-friendly newspapers as his calling the governor an uneducated plowboy. He called our war hero, President Eisenhower, Atlas. And he basically said, this makes me embarrassed to be an American. And the same newspapers that had attacked him for being an Uncle Tom now were attacking him as being an unpatriotic American. But Dwight Eisenhower listened. And I'm convinced that that, as much as anything that happened, is what convinced our president to finally send in federal troops to protect those Little Rock Nine kids. And it was Louis Armstrong at his best, and it was basically saying to America, if you think I'm an Uncle Tom, you don't get who I am and where I came from, and now I'm going to finally take it in a really public way and speak out the way I've been dying to do forever.
Hmm. Which he did. Duke Ellington, you tell us, his version of subversion, while comparably low-pitched and non-confrontational, was more straightforward. And you go on to outline some specific ways in which Duke Ellington unashamedly went about the work of activism, although it too was in a very different way from Armstrong, still in some ways stark contrast to his elegant public persona and what a lot of his music was about.
So, Duke Ellington, let's start with the kind of incident and the kind of indignity that Ellington, even though he may have been the best-known band leader in the world, the kind of indignities he had to suffer. One night when he was performing in Lynchburg, Virginia, he was looking for a hotel room, and the general network of blacks, the Green Book and other networks of blacks that would tell you where a safe place was in a particular community was unavailable to him in terms of Lynchburg, and there was no private Pullman sleeping car waiting for him. And finally, his manager found a hotel that would accept him, but said, of course, we're going to have to charge extra for the sheets and bed pillows. And the manager said, what do you mean, charge extra? And the hotel owner explained, well, because, of course, having a black man stay here will have to burn them when he gets done sleeping on them. And that's the kind of thing that Ellington had to deal with. And for much of his career, Ellington said, I'm going to let my music speak for me. And he would write symphonies like Black, Brown, and Beige that told the story of blacks in America from slavery through Reconstruction to the Civil Rights era. He would, over time, write songs that took a stronger and less subtle approach to telling the story of blacks in America. And my favorite was a song that was written around the time of the Birmingham riots, where a police chief in Birmingham, Alabama, named Bull Connor, set fire hoses on black kids who were protesting in the streets. And Duke Ellington wrote a song called King Fit the Battle of Alabama. talking about how this miserable police chief was turning fire hoses on young black kids who were just trying to demonstrate to get greater rights. But finally, in the early 1960s, when he was in Baltimore, and kids from Johns Hopkins University were trying to integrate a local diner and that wouldn't serve blacks, they asked Ellington to join them in their sit-in. He said no. They asked him again. He said no. The third time they asked him, he finally said yes. And the headlines around the world the next day were Duke Ellington joins sit-in, restaurant integrates. And it was, he showed the kind of clout that just getting involved with something as simple as a sit-in, he showed the kind of clout that he could have, and he showed that he, like Louis Armstrong, reached a boiling point where he finally had to speak out in a way that really mattered. And the one who understood better than anybody the impact of what he was doing and what Louis Armstrong was doing was a guy named Martin Luther King, who basically said, if not for these guys, we would never have been able to achieve goals like integrating our schools. They set the table for us, and they wrote the soundtrack to our civil rights movement.
Hmm. What about the case of your third musician, Count Basie, who was someone who, for most of his career, you tell us, barely uttered a word from the stage, with simplicity remaining his hallmark? What was the way in which Count Basie had an impact comparable to the other two?
So long before Little Rock, long before that sit-in in Baltimore, Count Basie was out there in his quiet and understated, but I think equally effective as an insurrectionist way, doing things like what he did in 1945, when he said, he wrote into his contract language saying, I will not play anywhere that is not allowing blacks and whites to be in the audience and that's not allowing me to have white members of my band. And he understood that in this subtle way of showing that the sky wouldn't fall if blacks and whites listened to music or played music together, he understood that that would make a difference in a way that speaking out or just letting his music speak for itself didn't. And he was the first to integrate theaters across the country. He was the one who went to Las Vegas, and when he was the headliner in a band in Las Vegas, he could headline and be the lead entertainer, but still be told you have to enter through the kitchen. And thanks to what he did, with help from a pal named Frank Sinatra, they integrated settings in Las Vegas that had never seen integration before.
Hmm. We're speaking with Larry Tye about his book, The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. We've been touching on some of the ways in which that was very clearly and maybe overtly true. But your book is also about how, in far more subtle fashion, they made a tremendous difference wielding their music as an extraordinarily effective tool. You write, and then this is true in the 1950s, with Negroes constituting just 10% of the population, you needed support in white America. That is, in order for truly revolutionary things to occur in terms of basic rights for black Americans. You write, no trio did as much as Duke, Satchmo, and the Count to set the table for the insurrection by opening white America's ears and souls to the grace of their music and their personalities, demonstrating the virtues of black artistry and black humanity. And you go on to say that they managed to do this, but they did it carefully. Explain the way in which they did things on this front dramatically and yet carefully.
So hearing you read that makes me wish you had done the audio version of the book. What they did was, so here's what I think happened, and I wasn't there in every household to know what was going on, but I think what happened was that white men who would never have allowed a black man to cross their threshold wooed their sweethearts with the tunes from the gravel-throated Satchmo Armstrong and the elegant Duke Ellington. I think that white women who never, if they saw a black man coming towards them on the sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. When they were in the privacy of their own living rooms, they kicked off their high heels and they tapped their toes to the swing of the Count Basie band. I believe that for once, when they were listening to these three musicians, race fell away as an issue and America simply listened rapt. And that kind of understanding, that kind of subtle creeping into American households and American consciousness proved not just that these three were great black musicians, but that they were great geniuses of whatever color. And there's only so long is like blacks don't deserve equal rights when they hear music as graceful and as magnificent as these three performed for a full half century.
Hmm. You write, if James Brown, Chuck Berry, and Little Richard are rightfully credited with opening the door to the acceptance of black music, it was Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington who inserted the key in the lock. I do want to make sure to take a couple of minutes, if we can, to talk about something else that is important, and that is that you say outright in the preface, none of these three men was a saint, not even close. And of course, that is one of the things that happens when we probe into just about anybody's life, is that we find things that are characteristics that might be unattractive, perhaps even offensive. Can you just say a word about this aspect of the three lives? And I mean, I guess I'm especially curious about how you felt you needed to explore the moral failings or weaknesses of these three men as you wrote about them. I mean, how did that need to figure in the portraits that you crafted?
Sure. I want to take your listeners back to my last book, which was on Senator Joe McCarthy. And he was, in lots of ways, a vile character, a mean guy. But if I hadn't found good things to say about him as well as the bad things, nobody should believe what I wrote, because there's good in everybody. There's also downsides in everybody. And with these three musicians that I wrote about, they were all men of faith. They believed in God. They prayed before every meal. They read the Bible. And in Duke Ellington's case, if you believe him, he said he read it cover to cover three times. But we could spend an hour talking about all the commandments that they broke. And the one that I think is most emblematic and suggests that these were flesh and blood, real characters with bad sides as well as good, was their inability to remain faithful to their wives. Louis Armstrong had four wives. Even with his last wife and his by far longest-lasting wife, Lucille, he was unfaithful. She knew it, he admitted it, and he just couldn't control himself. And he would say, Jesus, because I'm on the road 300 days a year, that's no excuse. Lots of people are on the road perpetually and still are in love enough with their spouse that they remain faithful. Count Basie was only married twice, but he was unfaithful enough to his nearly lifelong wife that she walked out on him twice, and she only came back when it was for the sake of their daughter, and she may have gotten a new mink coat from it. The one who stayed married for his entire life to the same woman was Duke Ellington, but he only lived with her as a real husband for 3 or 4 years. And after that, he had more mistresses than I could keep track of. And the reason he stayed married to his wife for all that time was because it was a perfect foil with the mistresses. Anytime one of his mistresses said, marry me, he would say, I'm already married, and you don't want me to go through a difficult and expensive divorce. So all of them, on everything from their addictions to drugs or alcohol or superstitions, they all had downsides. But as I say, in the end, it made them, in my mind, even more heroes, because they were real heroes, believable ones with good and bad points, and the good just outnumbered the bad by a lot.
Hmm. You write, their secreted sins, which I discuss at length, made my trio more fully dimensional, if less virtuous, and more able to understand their imperfect listeners, even as they were less suited to preach to them. A last question. You, as we've already touched on, came to this as someone with very little background in music. I wonder, in your exploration of their lives, how much time did you end up actually sitting down and listening to their music? And if you did that, did it make a big difference in the way this book took shape? If you chose actually not to spend too much time doing that, maybe you could explain that choice.
So I went to bed and woke up in the morning to the jazz of these guys. One of the nice things in this era, it's easy to do that. You just tell your Alexa device to play Louis Armstrong's music or Duke Ellington or Count Basie, and it will do that. And if you tell it to play specific tunes that you're trying to understand as lenses into who they were and how they changed, it will do that as well. And I did that perpetually. That while this wasn't a book about their music, I had to understand their music. And I started out loving jazz and ended up loving it even more because I got to listen to it so much. And if you spend 3 years of your life the way I did, delving into the depths of the life of a difficult guy like Joe McCarthy, my reward to myself and my publisher's reward to me was getting to spend 3 years calling it work, listening to the music of Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, which was an amazing joy.
Hmm. As you write, I think it's in the acknowledgments, in thanking publisher Bruce Nichols, you said, I thought that writing about three people, I'd spend a third of the time on each that I had with bios of single subjects. That, of course, was naive. I needed to devote the attention to each as if he was the sole focus. That's evident in my stack of 8,200 pages of typed notes and interview transcripts. But don't feel sorry for me. Can you imagine better company to keep during a COVID lockdown than Satchmo, Duke, or the Count? The book, again, is The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And the book includes wonderful photographs and illuminating portraits of all three of these amazing musicians. It's published by Mariner Books, the author, Larry Tye. Larry Tye, congratulations on yet another marvelous book. And thank you so much for being my morning show guest. It was so great to speak with you again.
It was a blast. Thank you, Greg.
And to finish out today's morning show, we're going to sample the greatness of Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, and Duke Ellington. We begin with Count Basie and a song which essentially was the signature song of the Count Basie Orchestra over the course of a half century. It's a piece called 1 o'clock Jump, which Count Basie wrote in 1937. A very typical example of Basie's early riff style. It's a wonderful showpiece for each and every section of the orchestra, with Count Basie, of course, at the piano. Here it is, 1 o'clock Jump by Count Basie. Thank you. Count Basie and his orchestra with their signature tune, 1 o'clock Jump. For Louis Armstrong, I actually want to choose the song Hello Dolly, because in Larry Tye's book, The Jazzman, he tells a wonderful story about Louis Armstrong's recording of this great song from the musical of the same name by Jerry Herman. Louis Armstrong was approached by his manager to make a demonstration recording of the song Hello Dolly in late 1963. The song's publisher was going to use it to promote the upcoming Broadway show, which opened roughly a month later. And it was almost exactly simultaneous with the opening of the show that Cap Records released Armstrong's demo as a commercial single. And it ended up ending the Beatles' streak of 3 chart-topping hits in a row, reaching number 1 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. And it actually became the most successful single of Louis Armstrong's career. And by the way, some months after the record's release, Armstrong was performing and began hearing from the audience, as those moments would come where requests would be shouted, that they were shouting for him to sing some song called Hello Dolly. He had essentially forgotten it. I mean, he'd done this demo sort of as a lark and then had promptly really forgotten all about it. So they actually had to go to the folks presenting Hello Dolly the musical in order to secure the music so this song could be incorporated into Louis Armstrong's performances. So here it is, that recording made back in 1963, released in 1964, Louis Armstrong in the song Hello Dolly.
Hello, Dolly, this is Louis Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can't tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying, but the band's playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas, find an empty lap, fellas. Dolly, never go away again.
That was Louis Armstrong's original recording of the title song from Jerry Herman's musical, Hello Dolly, the single most successful recording of Armstrong's long career. We finish out with the great Duke Ellington, who through the course of his life and career became increasingly ambitious and adventurous, both musically and artistically. Among his most significant works is one titled Black, Brown, and Beige, discussed at some length in Larry Tye's book, The Jazz Men. This was written for the 1943 Carnegie Hall concert. Duke Ellington actually constructed a 33-page verse narrative in which he traces the history of an African man named Bula and tells of his arrival in America by slave ship, his servitude in this strange land, his emancipation, his discovery of the blues, his move to Harlem, and finally, his hope of a new era of greater equality with the onset of the Second World War. What we're going to be hearing is actually an arrangement for full symphony orchestra done by Duke Ellington at the request of conductor Maurice Perez, who conducts this recording with the American Composers Orchestra. It is from a CD on the Music Masters label called Four Symphonic Works by Duke Ellington. Here it is, a portion of the suite drawn from Black, Brown, and Beige.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington and a portion of the suite drawn from Black, Brown, and Beige. Conductor Maurice Perez with the American Composers Orchestra. And once again, the book that we discussed today is called The Jazzmen by Larry Tye. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview from The Morning Show archives with well-known Racinian Linda Fleshinsky, talking about a lovely book that is a collection of some of her finest essays called In What Light There Is. And on Friday, best-selling authors Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood talk about their latest thriller called Red Star Falling. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the program archived on our website, wgtd.org. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.